It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
There has been so much going on between earthquakes and eclipses that I haven't had a chance to talk about this. Paul McCartney and Beyonce. She has done a cover of the Beatles song that he wrote, Blackbird. Now, a couple of remarkable things about that. One is, it's about a 60-year-old song. More importantly, when Blackbird came out, you know, this is before social media, when everybody was interviewed every 10 minutes. Most Beatles fans, including me, assumed it was a song about a bird and trying to be able to fly. It was only later, I guess, when Paul talked about this in interviews, that he said it was barely about civil rights. Because unlike John Lennon, you know, who would just come out and write political songs against the Vietnam War and other topics, you know, Paul didn't like to be too political in public, so this was kind of coded. That it was about black people struggling for their rights. So here you have Beyonce, probably the most famous African-American singer on the planet, doing, and I've listened to it, it's a very nice cover with harmonies and so forth, and Paul is praising it. He says he is so happy that she did this and she did such a great job because it must be deeply gratifying for him at the age of 81, not just to have, I mean, his songs have been covered a million times, going back to Yesterday and all the classics, but to have this African-American woman pick up on and perform this song that was about civil rights. Okay, just going to go straight into story number one. Listen to this New York Times headline. O.J. Simpson, football star whose trial riveted the nation, dies at 76. Seriously? That's your headline? NPR had an even worse one. You know, it was something along the lines of Simpson, legendary football star, dies from cancer or dies at 76. And look, I'm not going to dance around this. This is not like debating the 2020 election. Or maybe in some ways it is. I don't have a lot of sympathy for O.J. Simpson. I usually try to say something redeeming when somebody dies, even if it's somebody whose, you know, politics I disagreed with or was famous for some scandal or something like that. But he got to live until 76. You know who didn't? His ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson. And her friend, Ron Goldman. Their families didn't get to see them live beyond a young age. And you just can't get around that. I mean, as I've mentioned, you know, I was in Buffalo. I rooted for him when he broke the single season rushing record. And then he was, you know, in those Hertz commercials. Seemed like a very affable guy. He had a lot of friends. But then this happened. And of course, in the trial in 1995, he was acquitted. A racially charged trial with a jury that was 2/3 black. And lots of black people celebrated. I'm going to get into that. And I understand, you know, if you're charged with some crime and you are acquitted, then a headline writer can't say, double murderer, O.J. Simpson. But he never acknowledged it. He tried to exploit it. particularly with that horrible book, If I Did It, where he basically says what happens but couches it as a hypothetical, which was going to be published by HarperCollins, but in the uproar, the publisher canceled it. And Ron Goldman's father, Fred Goldman, got the rights to it because of the $33 million civil judgment that Simpson never fully paid off, and added his own words to this, you know, Simpson, and I'm using air quotes here, confession. Yes, it was a wink and a nod to get him more publicity. Anyway, I there's been so much on this, and I think I hear a lot of people saying, I don't want to watch hours and hours of O.J. Simpson coverage. That may depend on, you know, if you're below a certain age, if you're younger than a certain age, you know, it wasn't the same experience as living through it. I mean, I had to cover this for 2 years. It was a media phenomenon and an appalling spectacle. And so here's a piece saying, here's the New York Times, which actually changed its obit because of blowback. Here's the note. The Times published its obituary for Simpson shortly after the announcement of his death. It described the athlete's lifetime accomplishments and controversies. The paper drew some outrage, however, because the obituary stated the following. He ran to football fame on the field and made fortunes in movies. But his world was ruined after he was charged with killing his former wife and her friend. That was changed to, he ran to football fame and made fortunes in movies. His trial for the murder of his former wife and her friend became an inflection point on race in America. There was another change. Originally it said, the infamous case, which held up a cracked mirror to black and white America, cleared Mr. Simpson, but ruined his world. The new version, the jury in the murder trial cleared him, but the case, which had held up a cracked mirror to black and white America, changed the trajectory of his life. Yes, the jury in the murder trial cleared him. If you just say he was cleared, it almost sounds like you as a newspaper, you as a news organization, saying, yeah, you know, he was cleared. I've tried very hard to understand the different perspectives on this. And I just saw a headline today on CNN, you know, awaiting word on Simpson funeral plans. I mean, this guy's death should not be celebrated. I don't think there should be live coverage of the funeral. This is not like, well, he led a pretty good life, but he just made this one mistake. It's just infuriating. And if you live through, and in my case had to cover issues surrounding that criminal trial and then the civil trial, which at least was an attempt to hold O.J. accountable, and then he ends up in prison for 9 years for stealing sports memorabilia, and a lot of people felt, okay, well, finally there was some measure of justice. O.J. behind bars, even if not for the double murder. So here's a piece that says nearly 30 years later, O.J. Simpson's arrest and murder trial in Los Angeles still evokes strong memories. There was the glove, the Bronco chase, the minute-by-minute national television coverage. And for many Americans, Simpson's case will be also remembered for how it exposed the deep divisions between black and white Americans. The nation's view of the acquittal largely cleaved along racial lines. coming a few years after the acquittal of four officers who beat black motorist Rodney King in 1992. That was an awful story. And the 1991 killing of black teenager Latasha Harlins by a store clerk in L.A., Simpson's treatment by the police and media was viewed by many in the black community as proof that even wealthy celebrities couldn't escape racism in America. This is according to a professor of Afro-American studies at the University of Massachusetts. Amaklar Shabazz says, when the verdict was reached, we had one side of the screen with white people crestfallen, and crying. And then we had the other side of the screen, black people jumping up and down for joy. For joy. And I got to say here, Uh, 20 years after the verdict, Washington Post ABC poll, 2015, black Americans were less likely to believe Simpson was guilty. But the gap started to narrow. So back in 1997, 31% of black Americans said that they were definitely or probably sure of Simpson's guilt. By 2015, that had risen to 57%. Meanwhile, 83% of white Americans said Simpson was guilty, about the same percentage that held that view in 1997 as well as 2015. And here's another expert quoted as saying, it's not that black people have changed their minds about Simpson's innocence. I think in the barbershops today, black people are saying he got away with it. But the police got away with killing a lot more of us. That's the mentality. So the problem of that is, I understand. Okay, so the feeling was blacks were mistreated. This certainly was true in Los Angeles, not to mention lots of other major cities. And so a lot of them believed that OJ was guilty. But they liked the idea. They cheered. They were thrilled by the idea that one of them, a black celebrity, as opposed to a rich white person, a wealthy white person, had beaten the system. The only problem with that reasoning is that it leaves out the fact that there are two dead people whose lives were cut short by a bloody knife. And before I move on, here is an interesting piece by Dan Abrams, who, like a lot of people, got fame and recognition by being a legal commentator during the OJ era. There are others, Greta Van Susteren, and she later had a show with Roger Cossack, a legal show, and Nancy Grace and others. Anyway, here's what Dan Abrams writes. O.J. Simpson died today, and for me, it's actually an incredibly odd day because I covered every day of both his criminal and civil cases from inside the courtroom. The reality is his cases jump-started my career, and yet he was a murderer. It's sort of a troubling reality I've always had to live with. So he was a courtroom reporter for Court TV, which was a sort of a fringe channel, but soared in popularity after this case. You know, that's the whole point I was making yesterday when I did a sort of a breaking news update on the podcast, which is, you know, this changed forever the way the media, and particularly television, covered cases, murder cases, missing white women, because there was ratings gold there. And they would take and continue to take, you know, local murder cases involving people you never heard of that ought to be a local news story and turn them into national melodramas. In any event, here's more from Dan. He was 2 years out of law school, and he was assigned to the OJ case because the network's two main reporters were busy on other assignments at Court TV. He said he had no idea he'd be covering this for the next 2 years. It was a mountain of evidence like I have never seen in a case that has gone to trial, ever. But despite all of that, those of us who were in court every day were not surprised by the verdict. The bottom line is, the country, in my view, rightly, was convinced the killer got away with it. And yet, on a kind of personal level, his legal issues, and more importantly, the deaths of two people, changed my life. It's a kind of an off thing to reconcile. I was doing my job, and I think I did it well enough. But at the end of the day, it's also true. The deaths of two totally innocent people helped make my career. And I have guilt about that. I always have. So today, yesterday undoubtedly when he wrote this, he was thinking about the families of Nicole Brown and Ron Goldman. And look, I mean, if you cover a hurricane or an earthquake that kills a lot of people and you gain some attention as a journalist, you know, it's a plane crash, it kind of comes in the territory. I don't know that Dan needs to feel guilty, but he does because he thinks, you know, you sit in that courtroom, both trials, it has a real impact on you. You're seeing family members testify. It's not just some TV drama that you turn on and off for the entertainment value because everyone's talking about it. And I'm hearing a lot of people or seeing them online saying, you know, enough already. We don't need to have hours and hours and hours of this coverage. But it was a where were you moment. Where were you for the white Bronco chase? Where were you when O.J. Simpson was acquitted?
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
Fox News Radio on demand on the Fox News app. Download the app and just click listen. When you swipe left, you can listen to your favorite Fox News talk shows live. Swipe right for the latest Fox News Radio newscasts on demand. Fox News Radio on the Fox News app. Download it today.
Story 2. Kamala Harris, says the New York Times, told her staff that Donald Trump would not support a national abortion ban before he did not support a national abortion ban. She said he would take a position that would muddy the waters. We need to make him own this, she said. So, she was already scheduled to go to Tucson. She'll be there today, and obviously she's going to talk a great deal about the Arizona Supreme Court ruling on that 1864 territorial law that not only makes abortion illegal except to save the life of the mother, but says that doctors who participate in this or any provider faces 2 to 5 years in prison unless Arizona's legislators find a way to overturn this. That will be the law of the land. And obviously, this is an issue the Democrats want to hammer home. It undermines, to some extent, Donald Trump saying, well, let's just let the states decide. And he did come out to his credit and said this goes too far, and he predicted it would be overturned in a couple of weeks. I'm not so sure. Republican Speaker of the Arizona legislature, the House, says he doesn't want to bring it to a vote. Will that change? And for Joe Biden, who, as this piece says, rarely mentioned abortion rights in his general election campaign, he now worries that the issue could alienate moderate voters. So he's letting go of Bidenomics. It was always kind of a dumb idea. And plus, inflation just went up a bit to 3.5%, which is really going to hurt Biden because that's an issue that people really care about. Now, you can say 3.5% is far less than the 9% it was after all that federal spending in the wake of the pandemic. Anyway, the new ad, and that these words you're going to hear over and over from anyone affiliated with the Biden campaign, and maybe Kamala Harris more than Joe Biden. Maybe she's a better messenger as a woman, and Biden is just not as comfortable. The closing shot says Donald Trump did this. Donald Trump did this. And here's a quote from the chairwoman of the Biden campaign, Jennifer O'Malley Dillon. The more and more we see these examples of women who have difficulty getting abortions, the more and more people are like, oh, God, that could happen to my family. That could happen to someone I love. It's not an issue people are going to forget. Okay, let me go to number three. The New York Times, 2 days late, has a piece on NPR. You've heard me talk about, write about, perhaps you saw me on Special Report talking about the senior business editor, award-winning Uri Berliner, talking about how NPR has gone off the rails and is just dedicated to liberal activism. So, I guess to its credit, the New York Times, 2 days late, says the NPR is facing both internal tumult and a fusillade of attacks by prominent conservatives this week after a senior editor publicly claimed the broadcaster had allowed liberal bias to affect its coverage. And there's a couple of quotes from Berliner, including saying that NPR has placed race and identity as paramount nearly every aspect of the workplace. And then you have, you know, reference to Donald Trump saying that the funding should be rescinded for National Public Radio. Then you have Edith Chapin, now the editor-in-chief. We're proud to stand behind the exceptional work our desks and shows do. Okay. But we believe that inclusion is critical to telling nuanced stories. So the paper talked to Berliner, who said, I decided to go out and publish this in hopes of something would change. It has not been disciplined by managers. Here's what I don't like about the New York Times piece. It doesn't cite any of the specific examples. There's nothing in there about Berliner saying that we did everything we could to damage Donald Trump's presidency. There's nothing in there about NPR blowing off the laptop story and its managing editor saying it wasn't really a story, the Hunter Biden laptop story, of course. There's nothing in there about NPR being anti-Israel and pro-Palestinian. Again, these are the views of Berliner, and you can argue with them. But none of those examples. It's all like, oh, it's just a big internal uproar and so on. Now, here's the CNN newsletter for a show that was taken off the air. Donald Trump, Fox News, and other organs in the right-wing universe are holding up Berliner's piece to demonize the outlet. And then he quotes Trump as saying it's a liberal disinformation machine. Okay, the story is not that conservatives who have long criticized NPR, and even Berliner said it's always leaned to the left, but not like this. That's not the story. That's the story when you blame everything on conservatives. They have a right to speak out when a guy who did not like Trump, did not vote for Trump twice, writes this piece. That's not the story. The story is what Uri Berliner says about NPR. And meanwhile, as best as I could tell, there's been no mention of this on MSNBC. There's been no story about this in Politico. There's been no story about this in the Washington Post and other outlets. Now, if a similar high-ranking editor or producer at Fox News had written such a piece, you think there would be more than 10 minutes before everybody jumped on it? And I'm not saying Fox shouldn't and can't be criticized. What I'm saying is much of the mainstream media has blown this off.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
Story number four, the trial, which begins on Monday, the hush money trial. Politico says Trump faces an uphill battle, but he's got two possible strategies. First, take a wrecking ball to Michael Cohen, the former Trump lawyer slash fixer and a key witness. And it's true, and any defense lawyer would do this. And Michael Cohen does have credibility problems. Because he's been convicted and served time, including being convicted for lying. So that's, you know, how Cohen fares in his testimony will be a very big deal. The second one strikes me as completely unrealistic. Trump should try to get the judge to allow the jury to convict him of a misdemeanor. Now, is he dying to be convicted of a misdemeanor? No. But then he doesn't go to jail. But he's been charged with felonies, and I happen to think this is an inflated and rather partisan case by Alvin Bragg. But on what planet is the judge going to say, you know, I know he's been charged with these felonies, but jury, if you don't like that charge, why don't you take a lesser one? I can't really see that happening. Meanwhile, Speaker Mike Johnson meeting today at Mar-a-Lago with Donald Trump. They're going to talk about election integrity. Now, I don't know exactly what they're going to unveil, but this is going to give the speaker a chance to be shoulder to shoulder with Trump, even though they disagree on lots of parts of the House agenda, probably including Ukraine. But Mike Johnson has pretty good political instincts, and he knows that part of his job as speaker is to manage his relationship with Trump. And also, he could be working with the next president if Johnson himself survives this effort, or at least threatened effort, to oust him. Number five, story was broken by ESPN and the LA Times. And yesterday, federal prosecutors charged Shohei Ohtani's interpreter, Ipe Mizuhara, with stealing $16 million from the LA Dodgers star to pay off his gambling debts in dealing with the suspected illegal bookie. So the U.S. attorney out in California says Mr. Ohtani was a victim in this case, that he was such close friends with Mizuhara and, you know, relied on him, obviously, to kind of communicate with the world that doesn't speak Japanese. And that Mizuhara used his position of trust to plunder Ohtani's bank account. Now, that's a relief for the Dodgers. It's a relief for Ohtani, other than the fact that he's out a lot of money. But he does have the $700 million contract, most of that not paid yet. Major League Baseball was going to investigate, but it's put that on hold because of the criminal charges. And this is actually incredible. This guy, Mizuhara, wagered more than $180 million in 19,000 separate bets. But he won some, he lost some. Overall, the account lost $41 million. And then he tried to say that Ohtani had, you know, authorized covering his debts, all of which now, according to federal prosecutors, is not true. There is some talk that he may plead guilty. I don't see anything here about a denial from Mizuhara or his lawyers. And just sliding into one more baseball segment. The 2023 American League Cy Young Award winner, Gerrit Cole, is on the injured list with elbow trouble. The 2022 AL Cy Young Award winner, Justin Verlander, is out with shoulder inflammation. The 2021 AL Cy Young winner, Robbie Ray, will miss the first half of the season, coming back from Tommy John surgery. The 2020 AL Cy Young Award winner, Shane Bieber, needs elbow surgery too. That barely hints at what's going on, because pitchers are being encouraged to throw so hard that they're basically blown out their arms. This is according to the Washington Post. And then if you look at a bunch of other players, not just pitchers. Max Scherzer, well, he's a pitcher, of course. And others. It's easier to figure out who's healthy than who's not. Even for the healthiest of aces, injury seems like just a matter of time. The past decade or so, MLB has seen the number of Tommy John surgeries required by pitchers rise steadily. 10 years ago, it was called an epidemic by one orthopedic surgeon. It has only grown since. The Tommy John ligament, named for the pitcher Tommy John, matures at about age 26. In high school, the ligament, the sort of point where you have problems, is about 80 miles per hour. So this is a real problem for Major League Baseball. So many injuries. I mean, you can rattle off the last four Cy Young Award winners in just one league. It's pretty incredible, and baseball's got to figure out what to do about this. Now, I should have said at the top that I hope you have a good weekend coming up. I also should have said at the top that some of the things we've talked about here today, the Trump trial, OJ, abortion, Arizona, those and other topics will be featured on Media Buzz, 11 a.m., Sunday on Fox, that's 11 Eastern. I got a lot of work to do today to get this program in shape. So see you Sunday if you tune in. Otherwise, back here Monday with more BuzzMeter. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts and via Apple Podcasts, and Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, the Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.